Welcome to the Popcorn Talk Network, for the online broadcast network that features movie discussion, news, and interviews. Press one.
Popcorn Talk. We talk movies. In a world where action movies are constantly exploding at the box office, our heroes take on the monumental task of dissecting and analyzing all aspects of action movies to truly understand what it takes to make a great action film. Ben Bateman, Andrew Guy, in a Popcorn Talk Network exclusive, this is Action Movie Anatomy.
Boom! What's up, everybody? Welcome to the show. Where's my explosion?
Boom!
Start it over. Just kidding. Welcome to Action Movie Anatomy, guys. I'm Ben Bateman. Welcome back to the show. Welcome to another Wednesday. I'm sorry we got started a little late today. Just kidding. Our new start time is 1 o'clock. Also, just kidding. We were late. This is my co-host, Andrew Guy.
Hey, guys. How we doing? I had a holiday work party last night. Feeling a little hungover, but I am ready to talk about this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. We're doing Kill Bill today, guys. Kill Bill. Remember that movie? Oh, is it an action movie, you ask? It maybe is an action movie. We're going to talk about that on the
show
today.
Definitely is an action movie. It's 100% an action
movie. It's jam-packed with action. This is Action Movie Anatomy on the Popcorn Talk Network, the online broadcast network talking about movies and all things movie-related. This is our 34th episode or something like that?
34th, something like that.
Yeah, it's just a freight train, guys. It's an unstoppable freight train of enthusiasm and awesome.
Like a Tony Scott movie, if you will.
Yes, exactly like a Tony Scott movie. Like an unstoppable train.
We're talking about the movie Unstoppable. With
directed
the train
by Tony Scott, 2009.
Denzel.
We'll probably do it on the show someday. We will.
We won't. That is not an action movie.
The train is the villain. All right, guys. So we do action movies on the show here that fit four basic rules. They, aside from being made loosely after 1981, which is not necessarily a rule anymore, it's just kind of something we try to stick to. They have four rules that we stick to. Number one, the hero always plays by their own rules. Number two, the hero and the villain are always the smartest people, things, aliens, beings, dinosaurs, what have you in the room. Mm-hmm. Rule number three, the movie is driven by a police, military, political, or mercenary figure. When we say political, we mean they could be the man or work for the man, as in they could be an MTA operator in the Taking Pelham 123. And lastly, there's at least one explosion in the film. Now,
is there an explosion in this film?
This movie bucks the rules, I would say, pretty like clearly, because she's not like
she's a mercenary. She plays by her own rules.
Yeah,
she's definitely the smartest person in the room.
I still feel like, though, the villain, the real villain is Bill.
Is Bill.
And he's not in this movie, really. So she fights against, like, an underling who's just, she kind of, like, bests in a...
But the whole time the movie alludes to him being the boss, like, the bad guy.
And it does play to the whole point, which is that, like, when Tarantino is advertising his new movie, Hateful Eight, mm-hmm. Which comes out on Christmas, by the way, guys, which is why we're doing this, because obviously Tarantino movies are always a huge deal. He advertises as the eighth movie by Quentin Tarantino. And that only accounts if you consider Kill Bill one movie, because Grindhouse is the sixth or the fifth.
Well, he wanted it to be one movie initially. And I know you guys as an audience, you guys have talked about it on Twitter and you guys have talked about it on the live chat today. We're not going to talk about the second movie. We're talking about just one movie. And the reason for that is that if we were going to do both movies, it would be a completely different show that would probably have to be a lot longer because we're packing about a 4-hour movie into one show.
Absolutely, yeah.
I do love Kill Bill 2, and we might do it one day on the show. Probably not. It's much more drama-driven. It's a great movie. Ben actually likes it more than the first one.
I do.
But we are going to be talking about just the first movie today, and we're not going to be talking about all the things that it pulls from, either, like all the source material. That's for you guys to do if you want to do. That's not what we do on the show, even though it is very interesting, and Quentin Tarantino is one of the best people at pulling from other things and making it his own. That's not what we're going to talk about today.
So I think I'll use that as a springboard to get into our next thing here.
Okay.
And this is before we do actually doing it, I should remind you guys, we have a Twitter now.
We do.
The Action Movie Anatomy Twitter, the official Twitter, is AMA Podcast.
So, it's got 101 followers.
Yeah, we've had a slow burn. Maybe people finding it. It's been a lot of fun. So so check that out and give us a follow. We pretty much follow all of you back at this point.
Just we need it.
You know, we have a great relationship to our fans.
Right. And we don't talk like that.
No, I don't know whose voice that was. If you guys want to follow us personally, though, you can find me at Ben Bateman Media on Twitter and Instagram.
And you can find me at Andrew Guy on Twitter.
And let's get into thesis statement.
Yeah.
So this is how we start the show, guys. If you're fans of the show, you know that we do this. This is kind of like our moment to share a bold thought on the film. It's like a you come up with something kind of based in hyperbole almost. It doesn't have to be, right. But it should be strong, right? Like the boldest, the greatest, the best, the first, the only time this has ever happened or something like that. Just an idea that you can really stick with throughout the whole episode.
I liked mine this week.
Me too. And actually, I was reminded of it when you started talking about the source material.
Oh, really? Okay.
So what I'm going to go with is that more so than any director of our generation, Quentin Tarantino is as much a genre as he is a director. And this movie is the one that cements that idea. The ideology of Quentin Tarantino as a director, what his movies look like, they feel like, what they represent. Yeah. This is the one that really, like, sort of kicked that whole idea into the stratosphere. Because if you think about it, Reservoir Dogs, though it does the same thing, it's a shot-for-shot remake in a lot of senses of the original film, is a much more traditional movie.
It's like a gritty crime drama.
Yeah, it's got some scenes and it's got some of his Tarantino-isms, if you will.
Right.
But for the most part, it's just a really bloody, lots of swearing, lots of shooting, lots of violence. Awesome movie.
This is the only movie he's done, I believe, up to this point, that had less than 100 fucks in it.
17? Is that the number?
17, which is just amazing to me.
Yeah, it's crazy. You know, Reservoir Dogs is that. So then you look at Pulp Fiction. Pulp Fiction is the gold standard of what his movies ended up being like.
Right.
Nobody will ever argue that Pulp Fiction is not his best movie. And I don't think he'll ever be able to make a movie better than that because it's like one of the 50 best movies ever made.
Right, because he has just enough of his Tarantino-isms in it to make it like a great piece of art without slapping you in the face. And that's why in this movie I think that it works is because of the type of movie that this is. If there was as many Tarantino-isms in Pulp Fiction, it would not be as good of a movie.
What I think it is that I think the movie's jam-packed with them. I think it was just the first time, so we didn't know what we were looking at yet. And now it's been – the movie is so sort of cloaked in legend that when you watch it, it doesn't feel like he's trying to redo himself. It's like he's – it was fresh. And it still feels that way because it's such a classic.
Okay.
So then Jackie Brown is, again, it's actually his...
he, like, regresses.
It's his most linear movie.
Yeah.
It's the one... It's not as gritty as Reservoir Dogs, and it has some of his stuff in it, but it's really, like, it's an Elmore Leonard book that's been adapted, and you can tell that he adapted a book. He didn't write an original screenplay.
Right, right.
So the reason I say that this is the one that cements the idea, this is Quentin Tarantino being like, okay, you guys want guns and you guys want fuck. I'm going to say fuck 17 times, have the movie driven by a woman, and have it harken back to 70s kung fu movies. Most of you probably don't even know the genre, but I'm Quentin Tarantino, so you're going to watch it.
Yeah.
I'm going to have Uma Thurman do all kinds of things. She's going to use the square thing. She's going to say lines that you're like, the whole time you're like, am I supposed to know that's from somewhere? Is this lifted from somewhere? Are you just doing it to be Quentin Tarantino? Or are you just like, right, like, she just says something that, like why does she say it that way?
Right. But there's things in this movie that if you don't know the source material, you also wouldn't know that they pulled from old things.
And I don't know the source material. That's my point. So my point about it being the one that really cements him as a genre is that when I tried to think about why, because Andrew and I disagreed on this movie being in the genre, not as much as like, I only had seen it once, to be honest with you guys. I had seen it when it was in theaters, and then this was the second time I watched it.
And I had seen it about 20 times over the last 12 years.
So the parallel experience was not parallel whatsoever.
Yeah,
at
all.
We had a different feeling about the movie, and I really enjoyed it this time. I thought it was awesome. Like, I was much more willing to enjoy it, I think, because I wasn't a teenager.
Right.
But my point was, like...
You weren't one of those Tarantino kids anymore?
Because that's what I had been originally.
Yeah.
But so, like, when I really think about it, like... who he's become in our culture when we go see a movie, it's like they always have a certain amount of action, they always have a certain amount of gore, they've always got a lot of cursing. The characters all in this sort of weird universe feel like they all could be in each other's movies a little bit.
Right.
Like, they all feel like they're parts of the same kind of, like, you know what I mean? They all talk in a similar way. So that's what I mean. This movie has so much action. This movie has far more action than many of the action movies we've done on the show.
Yeah.
This is a better movie in the sense of how it's shot, in how it's paced, than many of the movies we've done on the show.
Yeah.
It just doesn't feel like our show necessarily. It feels like a Tarantino movie, which is weird. And I was trying to think, what does that mean? And that is what it is. He has his own genre.
Yeah. I mean, I can agree with you to an extent on that part. Like, I do agree that Tarantino movies feel like Tarantino movies, like Inglourious Bastards and Django and Kill Bill 1 and 2, they all feel a certain way.
And people try to rip them off. People try to do movies that feel like his movies.
But I feel like Kill Bill Volume 1, for me, doesn't quite feel that way enough to pull it outside of our genre.
Interesting.
You know what I mean? Yeah, like, yeah. I really feel like there's enough action in this movie, and it's a type of action that I like, and it's a movie that, like, it's like a feel-good movie to me, too.
Right.
Like, and that's one thing I love about a lot of the movies that we do on the show, is that they make you feel a certain way, kind of like what we talk about with our fist pump moments. Like,
yeah.
Fuck yeah. Like, this is right. awesome. It's the music. It's the shots. Yeah, it's the tracking shots. It's the acting. Like, and that's going to lead into my thesis statement. And my thesis statement is that I believe that Uma Thurman is, in the same sense that Denzel is to Tony Scott, she is Quentin Tarantino's muse. She is at her best when she is with Quentin Tarantino. Yeah. Whether it's Pulp Fiction or Kill Bill 1 and 2, she gives her best performances, and she's just, there's something like just engaging about her, and just, you just want to watch her.
Yeah.
And I don't get that from her doing anything else.
Well, and she's also the best female character that's in any of his movies.
Absolutely.
She's at her best. And then, like, in his treatment of a female character is, like, at its best when she's involved.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I mean, my point was less to say that it doesn't fit the genre, more to say that when I tried to put my finger on what genre it is, to try to establish why I didn't feel like it, I couldn't. It's its own genre. Like, I think about other movies that have tried to rip off Tarantino.
Right.
You know, you think about movies like Smoke and Aces, or you think about these movies that are like these sort of like slick crime things with lots of cursing and quirky characters
and
that
gritty,
shoot guns.
Yeah.
And like, they're usually just worse versions.
Smoke and Aces is kind of sweet.
Yeah, but they're usually worse versions of what he does.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can't.
Yeah.
I guess I can't say that you can't do it as good as the person that originally did it, because that's basically what Quentin Tarantino has proven.
Yeah.
Is that you can do it as well as the original person, just in a different way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, okay, a great example of a movie that is trying to be what he was and sort of succeeded, but, like, in retrospect, when you go back to watch it, it just feels like this really kind of campy, bad treatment of the genre, is Boondock Saints. This was a movie where at the time people loved it.
Yeah.
It was
a huge
classic.
Cult classic. Yeah.
And you find out about the guy that wrote it. And he was not trained. He was, like, I think a bouncer. He was a guy in a band. And he, like, wrote an original screenplay with a bunch of, like, quirky characters that fire guns and say cool shit. And then in the end, the movie ages poorly because, though Quentin Tarantino, and we'll get into this when we talk about him, you know, he's a video store kid that just made his own movies.
Right.
He didn't go to film school. Or I don't recall. But, I mean, he's basically a self-taught guy.
Mm-hmm.
There's only a couple people ever that have been able to do that, where, like, they're at that level by just being a movie fan.
Right.
And so I think, you know, he's remarkable. I mean, he's a truly remarkable part of our generation.
He is one of the greatest directors of our generation.
Yeah, I would say of our generation, he's the most iconic, probably.
Yeah, because he appeals to the mass audiences in ways that others that I respect a lot don't.
Yeah, he might have been the most influential. I think Peter Bogdanovich actually stated in something that he was the most influential director of our generation.
Cool. All right. Well, let's watch the trailer here.
Yeah,
so we can get that going. And then we can get into our fist pump moment. There's a lot. There's a lot of them.
Mm.
Not too long ago, I was quite the professional. My friends and I, we were the creme de
la. It's so funny because I don't remember this trailer at all.
And we all
worked for this me neither. Like,
Bill.
I remembered it starting with that sweet song that plays. Which is in here. Things right here. Oh no. Oh, yeah.
I guess they should have tried a little harder.
So I suppose it's a little late for an apology, huh?
You suppose correctly.
Now it's kill or be killed.
You have every right to want to get even.
Get even? Even, Stephen?
I would have to kill you. That'd be about square.
And I choose kill.
See, I remember it's opening with the song, this song. It's almost what?
They make the trailer much more Tarantino-y than the movie is.
We deserve to die.
Like, the parts they pull for, like, comedic value.
Yeah, totally. And I mean...
That's just from number two.
Yeah, totally.
Pai Mei.
It's just funny, because, like, he's such a polarizing figure. I mean, those Tarantinos we're talking about, they're not like...
Did you see how in the trailer, like, her clothes are covered in, like, black?
Yeah.
You read about that? Yeah. There was a rule that was made after this trailer had come out that you can't have blood in trailers anymore because she was just soaked with it.
Interesting. I didn't read that.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
And that's why they had to change it to this black color.
think it was going to be that easy, did you?
This is a sweet trailer.
Yeah, it's good. Which is crazy when you consider when this trailer came out. This is in the same time period of a lot of those terrible trailers that
absolutely.
Watch. As a slave!
As a slave! So good. Sweet shot.
That might be the worst part of any trailer we've ever watched.
It is definitely the worst part of any trailer.
Yeah.
Like, the fact that they just... Was there an exclamation point at the end of it?
I think so, yeah. And it's written
it's
in,
the
like,
Matrix, right?
Yeah, it's written in, like, old, like, green, like... Yeah, it's the worst.
So that trailer was cool.
It's a pretty good trailer.
I think that it does a bit of an injustice to the film. It just seems... It makes it seem so much more campy than it is. And I know this film is.
Yeah.
But it's not that much.
I think it's... This is what we were saying before the show started. And so, as you said, you've seen the movie 20 times. And I had seen it once. So... And I was a huge Tarantino fan. Like, let me just say, like, I had read a biography on the guy. Like, I know a lot of history.
I didn't care about him at all.
Yeah. He was, like, the guy. Because at the age that I was in 2003, which would have been, like, 15 or something like that, you know, like, I was becoming a movie fan, like, an adult movie fan. I was, like, watching the AFI Top 100, and I was, like, watching all these movies trying to really, you know, like, I wanted to, like, impress my dad, essentially, right? He was, like, a big movie fan growing up. So, like, I was trying to really connect in, like, an intelligent way with movies. And Tarantino, as we said, the reason that I think he's such an important director is he was this very approachable figure because his movies were super enjoyable. They're kind of made for all ages, as a young guy especially.
Yeah.
You know, they're movies that really appeal to you. So I was amped for this movie. I just don't know the source material. Like, kung fu movies have never been my thing. So what ended up happening was, like, I watched it, got kind of swept up in the whole culture of teenagers feeling the same way I did, and was like, I want to be cool. I liked him before you guys liked him. I'm going to reject this movie because I wasn't that into it. I didn't want to watch it again. And so then as the years went on, I sort of had that feeling, and I just didn't really connect with people over this movie.
Right.
You had a different experience. You connected with people over this movie. This became a classic for you.
Absolutely. I mean, me and my roommates would watch this movie all the time in college.
Right.
Kill Bill 1 and 2. I mean, we watched a lot of movies a lot of times in college. Don't get me wrong. But this was one of them. This is one that was in the rotation. This movie's sweet, man.
It's a huge movie. I mean, it totally came out in the same era as a lot of the ones that we talk about on the show that were, like, huge for us.
Yeah.
Within a few years of Gladiator, within a few years of Matrix, Born Identity, these
Patriot.
Movies...
Love the Patriot.
Audible, guys, we're going to just start doing the Patriot episode live again. So, like, I think that's so fascinating because when I watched this trailer and I remember it coming out and everyone talking about it, like... It hasn't been in the canon for me. It doesn't register as a classic.
It's so funny because our experience of this is so different, and we're going to move on with the show. Don't worry. But the first time I saw this movie, it was when I think my mom was – she had friends over or something. I don't know what it was. I watched it on her 19-inch old-school CRT DVD-VHS combo in her room, and I remember sitting there. And, I was like 14 or whatever. I watched this when it came out, and it was just – mind-blowing to me. It was so intense. And, like, at this point, I've been a huge movie fan my whole life.
Yeah.
And I really love movies. But I didn't actually start to, like, critically analyze them and follow directors and stuff until about getting into college.
Yep.
I was just a guy that loved movies and knew everyone that was in any movie.
Yeah.
And I remember watching this movie, and I had to, like, fast-forward through parts because it was so intense. And I wanted to know what happened. Like, the very end was the part that I really remembered. Because I hadn't seen many people get as many limbs chopped off as in this movie, ever, in any movie, you know? And it was at the very end, and just when she's got Sophie, and she's got Sophie in the trunk, but then it cuts to Bill talking to her.
Yeah.
And I remember I was sitting there, and I was so nervous and anxious for what this Bill guy was going to do, because he was so evil. And I had to fast forward to the end of the movie and see that nothing bad happened, and then I rewound it and listened to the thing. And I love horror movies, so I don't know. I was chicken shit.
I didn't remember this movie being as violent as it was. I mean,
yeah.
It's not even violent in, like, a grotesque way,
mostly. It's not grisly.
No. It's just it's violent in, like, a very, like, over-the-top, campy, blood spraying
everywhere. It's almost like anime.
Yeah. It was just what I was trying to do. So let's get into Fist Pump Moment.
Yeah.
So this is the thing we do on the show, guys. If you watch the show, you know Fist Pump Moment is it's that moment where you're watching the movie. Something happens, and you kind of have this, like, fuck yeah. Is anybody else watching this movie?
Yeah,
this is just fucking awesome.
Yeah.
You seeing this right now? Maybe you get on the phone, you call your buddy.
Hey. Ben, I'm sitting next to you on the couch. What's up?
Hey, Andrew, I'm watching Kill Bill. It's fucking sweet, dude. It's really cool.
Yeah, man, I can see you talking on the phone right now.
Yep. So that's what we're going to do right now is we're going to share our fist pump moments. If you guys have a fist pump moment that you want to share with us, let us know. AMA Podcast on Twitter. You want to start?
Yeah, I have two, like, basically every single time I do anything on the show. but my first one is the knife to the chest when she throws the knife. Because first of all, I always think that throwing knives is super badass.
Yeah.
But it's when she kills Renita Green at the very beginning. Because the way the movie opened, the opening is sweet.
Yeah.
It's a gnarly opening at the wedding, and then it cuts to her in this fight. And you kind of see what you're going to get for the rest of the film.
Yeah.
And then they talk about it, and they go, you know, showdown at dawn or at 2 a.m. or whatever. And then, you know, she, very funny, bitch, very funny. And she pulls the cereal box, she shoots the gun, and then she just sticks her to the chest. Like, done. Dead. I love it.
if you're listening on audio, that's me
peeing?
Pouring something into my glass.
That's not what it was. And then the other part for me is when she's sitting there in the sushi restaurant in Okinawa talking to this guy, and she mentions Hattori Hanzo, and you hear the glass break in the back.
Yeah.
And then you hear the dude just looks at her.
Yeah.
And then he starts speaking in fluent Japanese.
Yeah.
It's just sweet.
It's totally
like,
sweet.
If you want a Hattori Hanzo sword, you gotta be able to speak Japanese, and you were able to find him, like, oh, it's just awesome.
Yeah.
So those are my two.
Yeah, that's a good scene. And Tarantino does so well with the, like, dialogue that builds tension in scenes.
Absolutely.
It's one of his best qualities.
Yeah, I mean, the scene in Inglourious Basterds in the bar is one of the best scenes ever. And that's the scene in the very beginning.
In the beginning, I was going to say, with the interrogation where she's under the floorboards.
Yeah, the whole family.
Yeah.
So good.
Yeah, a lot of... that's like one of his... Definitely got to be one of his best qualities. I mean, Samuel L. Jackson. That's a tasty burger.
Yeah.
Like, incredible.
He kills it.
Yeah, that's like one of his best qualities. So, my fist pump is... It's the opening, and it's... they've beaten the shit out of her. She's on the ground, and it's just before the first credit rolls, and what'd she say? She's like, Bill, it's your babe!
It's your babe! Yeah.
And then the...
Yeah.
And then, like, Kill Bill or whatever, is that what it says?
Super
or is it chapter one?
Something like that.
Yeah. That's that part, like, watching it this time, I was like, wow. I was like, this is sweet.
Yeah, I'm ready.
Yeah, that's intense. So that's my fist bump.
I dig it.
Awesome.
I dig it. Those were both very good. Or, I mean, all three of those.
Yeah, mine was pretty good.
It was all right.
let's get into star profile. So this is fascinating. Uma Thurman is like... So, like, Uma Thurman and Lucy Liu, that's, like, who we chose in this one. And we would have done David Carradine, obviously, except that he's really almost not in this movie.
Not in the movie at all.
Yeah. You hear him, and you see him, but you don't see his face, right?
Yeah, you see his hand.
Yeah, which is funny, because I think you see his face in the trailer, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I can't remember. Did we just see it?
I think we see his face in the trailer.
Like I said, I drank a lot last night, okay?
Still drunk. So Uma Thurman, the three movies listed before this are Chelsea Walls, Tape, and The Golden Bowl. So,
I know nothing about any of those movies.
Okay, so I looked them up.
Okay.
The Golden Bowl is a Merchant Ivory movie, which I think is James Ivory.
Okay.
And he's like a director that does... They're very like... My mom loved Merchant Ivory movies when I was growing up. She would always reference like Room with a View and like...
Saying that word like I know what it means.
Yeah, yeah. So The Golden Bowl, I don't know anything about the movie aside from like looking it up and realizing it was just part of that. I think... It wasn't a big hit from what I could gather.
Right.
I think it made a lot of money. Tape and Chelsea Walls. Chelsea Walls, one of them is an Ethan Hawke directed film. I think that's Chelsea Walls, maybe.
That was when they were married, right?
Yeah, yeah. And it's like a short with like a bunch of small parts. And I think she's got a small part in it. So the bottom line is none of these three movies that came out in the
she was a nobody essentially. I mean, not a nobody at this point, but her career had completely dropped off.
She had done Pulp Fiction when she was like 23, and then she had just kind of. But it seems like she was just kind of okay with that. Like she,
she's always kind of been. She's been like one of those people in Hollywood where she's not trying to be the big star, like A-list in every movie. Like everyone talks about her.
Yeah, it's sort of cool. Like she got the script for this for her 30th birthday, was it?
Yeah,
from Tarantino.
Absolutely. And he'd never pictured anyone other than her playing.
Yeah, he just wrote it and he gave it to her because they talked about the idea for this movie on set of Pulp Fiction.
Could you imagine that?
Just like Tarantino's like
one of the greatest writer directers at the time that you're in your 30s, and this role comes along. You're like, this is it. This whole thing, this movie, this that ends up being two movies, is you.
It's for you. I wrote it for you.
Exactly.
Yeah, you just get to have it. Happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
It's just going to make, it'll probably make your
blow
career.
Blow your career up, yeah. Which is interesting because we're actually going to do a little segment today.
Oh, yeah.
About that, aren't we?
We are, yeah. This will be a little later, but it's to tease you guys with it. We started Interest Top 5 on the show. So Tarantino has this thing that he likes to do where he'll take an actor that's either sort of like up and coming but hasn't quite broken through to the next level, mm-hmm. or he'll take an old actor that he used to love, that he was a fan of, that's now just languishing, and they'll put them in an awesome role and kind of resurrect their career.
Right, Travolta, and you look at Christoph Waltz and what he did to his career. You know,
yeah, you put one of these guys in one of your primo roles, and it really can just skyrocket the guy's career. So we decided we would play a game, which is top five actors or actresses that if Tarantino was to put into a movie now, we would want to see him sort of resurrect or skyrocket their career.
It's interesting because Jamie Foxx, kind of he did that because his career is already like rocky and kind of slowed down. It didn't work for him.
No.
I still don't want to see Jamie Foxx in anything.
Nope.
Even though I like Django.
Yeah, I don't like Django, but I don't hate Django.
I had to watch it again. I remember not liking it all the first time, and then I watched it again. I was like, oh, this is good. I watched it another time, and I was like, okay, I dig this movie.
Like most of his movies, I tend to like a lot of parts. That tends to be my, these days, my relationship to Tarantino movies is that I like a lot of sections of the movies.
Right.
And then there's a lot of sections I find annoying.
That's definitely how I feel about Inglourious Basterds and Django. But I hope that that's not the case with Hateful Eight.
I'm hearing great stuff. Hateful Eight looks sweet. I'm hearing really good stuff.
Yeah.
And if anybody's concerned about Kurt Russell's mustache, we are going to be doing Tombstone in January.
We are going to be doing Kurt Russell's mustache.
Yeah. So, yeah, let's get into...
Lucy Liu is interesting.
Yeah, she's got some credits that are a little bit more relevant.
A little bit. Chicago was huge at the time, but it wasn't because of her. But anyone that was in that movie, it gave their whole career a little bump.
Yeah, 100%. I mean,
it was a huge ensemble.
Yeah, Chicago's like one of those, you know how there's those Oscar winners that come out occasionally, like the Best Picture movie, where mm-hmm. everybody looks at each other and they're like, oh.
Right.
And then like 10 years later, you're like, that movie?
Right.
I have zero interest in watching Chicago ever again.
Yep.
Like, it's like that's not like it was bad. It's a great movie for what it is. It's just
like Moulin Rouge.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, and Nine.
I love Moulin Rouge.
I know you do. He's got the full wardrobe.
I mean, Nine is the ultimate example. Yeah. That movie starring fucking Daniel Day-Lewis.
Absolutely.
And it just, what even happened to that movie?
It just disappeared. Fell off.
Completely.
Yeah.
So, Charlie's Angels Full Throttle.
Boom! Whammy!
Things to remember about Charlie's Angels Full Throttle. Demi Moore in a bikini in her 40s.
That was like, mind-blowing.
People were like, God, she looks amazing.
She looks amazing.
She looks like 28.
Ashton Kutcher should marry her.
Yeah, and then they did. Weird.
Super weird.
Yeah, it was real weird. Charlie's Angels Full Throttle, Chicago, and then a movie called Cypher in 2002, which...
God damn you, Cypher!
Yeah. Enough said. yeah, needless to say, I mean, this was a big moment for both of them, but oddly enough, didn't really do that much for either of them.
No, not at all.
They didn't really, do much more. Like, Uma Thurman, she had a little bit more of a resurgence. I know she was in The Producers a few years later.
That movie was sweet.
Yeah, it's good. And she's good in it.
Ferrell kills it.
Yeah, he's hilarious.
It's amazing.
I know she's in that, and I know they did another... There's Before Sunset and After Sunset.
Mm-hmm.
And then, did they make a third one? Or has the third one maybe just been announced?
During Sunset.
Something like that.
I don't know.
But those are the Ethan Hawke, Uma Thurman.
Kill Bill 3 just recently got announced. I didn't get a read. Someone was talking on the live chat or something about a video or an interview that had come out about it. I didn't get to check it out, but I'm going to.
Yeah, Tarantino for a long time had said he wasn't going to do it. And mm-hmm. then in a more recent interview, he was like, well, we're considering it now.
See, I always wonder about things like that when... Because number two was a sequel, but it was a great sequel because it wasn't supposed to be one.
It was just part of the movie.
It was part of the movie. Yeah, yeah. So this is this is now 10 years gone, 12 years gone. Now we're going to maybe make Kill Bill 3. I just feel like it's kind of cheap.
Well, I think...
We'll see what happens.
I was reading that originally his intention was to make this his, Dollars trilogy, if you were, which is, that's, the reference to the old spaghetti westerns with Clint Eastwood.
Right.
So I think he wanted to sort of make, a whole cycle, and one of them was going to be an anime, and it was going to be about the kids growing up, the orphaned children coming back for revenge.
Okay. Yeah, I remember.
And the other one was going to be, a prequel, when the whole, Assassin Viper?
Deadly Viper Assassin Squad.
Yeah, when they were, up and coming, the sort of their origin story.
Right.
That was kind of the way that they had he had imagined it, but obviously this is a guy I'm sure that has a ton of projects on his mind.
Of course.
So anyway, we can move into a little bit of production development. Tarantino at this point in his career kind of had the keys to the kingdom a little bit.
Absolutely.
He was just sort of, which is weird too, considering Jackie Brown was kind of a flop.
Right, but wasn't it, it kind of was like a flop, but then awards...
People
like,
it liked
seemed like it should have been gunning for awards, I think.
Yeah, like that movie's sweet. Like I
here you go, man.
I'll pen it myself. Thank you. That movie's sweet, but it was not innovative in the way that Pulp Fiction
right.
or Reservoir Dogs had really blown doors open. So, but yeah, he was given a ton of time and money to make this movie.
Yeah, this movie shot for a long time.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, what was with the writing? It was like it took six years to write the entire script.
The whole thing, yeah.
Yeah, the original draft was about 220 pages long.
The final scene took 2 months to film.
Yeah.
It took 8 weeks.
Well, there's also so much of this movie is fight choreography.
That's amazing.
There's like dialogue, but then so much of it is just intense fight choreography.
It is, and that's another thing of why it might not feel like our movie is there is so much action in it, but it's shot like a Best Picture.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like the cinematography in this movie is amazing. I mean, the tracking shot at the end, there's two of them, but there's one that's a few minutes, like
actually,
2 minutes
long. Actually, we can cue it. We have it.
Oh,
up.
We have it? Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Let's cue the tracking shot. This took, 17 takes, and it took 6 hours to rehearse each time, basically. They just did it over and over and over. And it's perfect. It's great. These are the type of things when I watch, it makes me feel like a kid. Like I can enjoy it as a kid and as a movie critic. You know what I mean?
Totally.
Like you see things like this and it goes up and over and around and through and it's just amazing. It's like that tracking shot in Children of Men.
Yeah, yeah. So
good.
One
of my favorites.
I love that movie.
I love that movie. I wish we could do that on the show, but we definitely...
It's dramatic.
It's too dramatic. Charlie Brown, John. Our buddy Jason, who was on the show for the Predator episode and the... What episode did he just come on for?
Predator.
That was it. It was just the one. Oh, yeah, it was Matt. Matt had come back. Jason had come on. He dressed up as Chuck Norris in like a yellow outfit from the movie in the 80s for Halloween. And he looked exactly like that guy. Like 100%. It was amazing. Sophie.
Beautiful. She's my style.
Yeah, so I guess Tarantino was like finishing up scouting locations.
Yeah.
In Tokyo, I believe. Can't remember exactly where he was. And he was in like a convenience store or something and he heard this song come on over the radio.
Oh, yeah.
Like over the speakers. And he was like immediately just captured by it. So he went up to the clerk and he begged him. He's like, can I buy this CD from you?
The copy, right? Yeah, I read that.
And then he obviously bought it and immediately just found them and booked them in the movie.
Yeah, it's awesome.
It's crazy. Anyway, everyone's always... There's always someone watching. Always someone listening, you know?
Yeah, you never know. I mean, that's... I just can't believe this movie is as old as it is.
It feels like it's like 2006.
Yeah, it's just weird that like...
So sweet.
It's like a classic in some ways, you know?
It is. This is a total classic to me.
Yeah.
Like, I will show my kids this movie.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Charlie Brown, John. All right.
Yeah, so that's a pretty incredible scene. Hard to execute something like that.
Absolutely.
And always a great reminder of like sort of just how talented of a, and not even just that, but like how ambitious of a filmmaker Tarantino is.
Yeah.
He's always trying new stuff. You know, he's just like there's an anime sequence in this movie that's amazing.
It's amazing. It's done by Kazuto Nakazawa, who is obviously like a famous video game and anime designer and artist. But, and we're not, again, Sword Fighter, we're not going to talk about it a lot. But that was one of the first times that an anime scene had been in a huge like Hollywood blockbuster.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was
amazing.
Yeah, just like outside the box. Like just like let's just do this. And it's long too.
And like when you're watching it, like I remember when it first happened for a second, I was like, "What's happening here?" Like when I watched it as a kid.
Yeah.
But then it's so good.
Right.
It totally adds to the movie. It doesn't take away at all.
Yeah, it's done really accurately. Like I remember in middle school and high school I was a fan of anime. Like,
me too.
I watched a lot of anime.
Yeah,
I kinda
my best friend watched it and then I stopped. Yeah.
Yeah, but I just remember like the style this is done, the movement and everything. It's all very accurate, but it's so gory.
Yeah,
all the
gnarly
spraying blood and the one
punching out the teeth and like the crunching of the head. And
the one character who's like all like, you know, he's like the guy with the hair,
the
over
sleazy
his eye,
guy. Yeah,
and he's like sort of like with the sword. It's like pretty cool.
What is this movement?
I don't really know.
Yeah.
For those of you on audio, I was just dancing like some sort of a slippery creature of some kind. Do you know that there was 450 gallons of fake blood used in this movie?
Amazing.
450 gallons of blood.
Yeah, it was rumored that the reason that they went black and white is because they ran out of fake blood, which isn't true. I don't think you could.
It was a rating thing?
It was a rating thing. It was the MPAA was like, and Tarantino, of course, just owned it up and turned it into something that everyone was like, oh, well, it's an homage to this and that. No, it's not.
No.
Even though it could be, it wasn't. He did it because it was too gory. It was too much blood for an R-rated movie at the time.
Yeah. It's
and
crazy.
I loved it. And the black and white there worked too.
Yeah, homage to so a black and white photography is ultimately an homage to the 70s and 80s U.S. television airings of kung fu movies. Black and white were used to conceal the shedding of blood from television censors. Originally, no black and white photographic effects were going to be used, and in the Japanese version, none are. But the MPAA demanded measures be taken to tone the scene down.
Absolutely.
Which I think is exactly what you just said.
But it's exactly what I said, but it's written.
But it's verbatim.
It's verbatim.
I felt it was important to read that. Yeah, so I mean, moving on to Tarantino and Lawrence Bender.
You're really helpful.
Produced by Lawrence Bender.
Lawrence Bender, Tarantino's homeboy.
Yeah, so he's been. This is really interesting because this movie's massive in scale. It accomplishes a lot. It's impressive looking. Most of the time when we do a movie and it looks like this movie looks, there's like 13 producers listed.
I know.
And you always have to choose the three or four that were the most relevant, and then we talk about them. But Lawrence Bender is Tarantino's guy.
He's the sole credited executive producer.
Yeah. He works with Tarantino and has. I don't know on the later films if that's the case.
Yeah, he didn't do Death Proof Django and he's not going to do Hateful Eight. But everything up till...
Yeah.
Inglourious?
Okay.
I think
if I remember correctly, and if somebody's watching knows this and I'm wrong here, feel free to shout me out. But I want to say they had a falling out. I'm pretty sure I recall reading something about this.
Well, I've heard Tarantino's kind of a prick.
Yeah, that's what you hear. But
also cool, though.
Yeah, and he's like one of those creative people where it's just like hard, you know, people that have a vision, they're visionaries where they see the world in a specific way exactly what they want.
It's like Cameron.
Yeah. It's like you're not going to be happy if someone else is not giving you what you want. You want exactly what you want when you want it.
And you want the support of the people around you.
So here's the question. Are the visionaries that are dicks actually like true visionaries, or is it just that they were in a lucky enough position to get the money and the support to do what their vision was, and that if anybody else with good ideas got the same opportunity, they would make awesome shit too? It's just that they struck gold and now they just get away with it.
I don't know. I'm sure part of it is
a little bit of A, a little bit of B. Yeah,
but I think it's a lot more of like, because you look at these guys that, I mean, Nolan hasn't really ever been called a dick, but
right?
You look at these people like P.T. Anderson, Nolan, Boyle, Spielberg, Cameron. Yeah. There's a reason, Tarantino, there's a reason that they're the best at what they do.
Yeah, 100%.
And it's this visionary, like, I see this happening and we're going to make it happen no matter what. And you can either be with me or you can get the fuck out of here.
Well, and getting lucky once is different than making a whole career's worth of, like...
Right, and all of these guys that I just mentioned have an incredible...
track record.
Like, I celebrate the guy's entire catalog.
So anyway, that's pretty much what there is to know. There's not a whole lot of story. You know, with Tarantino, He's a guy who grew up working in a video store, and with the invention of VHS tapes, you know, he had a VCR, and he worked in a video store, and he watched all these movies, and he just sort of...
What movie was it? The director of...
Yeah, Brian Helgeland walked in to the video store that he was working at.
Man on Fire.
And Tarantino told him to watch it, and he did. And then years later, when Tony Scott was doing the remake, Helgeland rewrote it.
Of course.
Yeah.
And it's all because of Tarantino. I love that. That's a cool story. Cool how things come back around like that.
Yeah, yeah.
I worked in a video store. Maybe I'm a visionary.
I worked in a video store, too.
No, you didn't.
Hung out in one a lot and sometimes talked to customers.
Point Break kids back.
Hey, have you seen Bridget Jones' Diary? me neither.
It's an Academy Award winner.
Can you buy me this popcorn?
So with Tarantino, it's tough because we could sit here and we could talk about him for the length of this whole show because of who he is.
Yeah, so I think we'll just point out a couple things that for anybody who's like seen Kill Bill but maybe is not like super aware of his career. So Tarantino is one of these guys who, because he grew up as such a fan of movies, he's obsessed with recreating moments that were important to him. And this has been the story of his whole career. So his original film, the first feature film that was, you know, released wide, was Reservoir Dogs. That's the movie that broke him. And that's a great movie. Reservoir Dogs to date is still my favorite Tarantino movie.
I think
Pulp Fiction's a better movie, but Reservoir Dogs is the Tarantino movie that, like, every time I'm watching.
First time I watched that movie, it was so intense.
Yeah, so fucking cool.
Yeah.
And that movie, I want to say the original film is called City on Fire.
Mm-hmm.
I could be wrong, but
it's very close to that. I'll pull it up.
It's called Infernal something.
Carnal Desires?
No, it's like Infernal something. But Infernal Affairs? Infernal Affairs, I think.
How about you just continue your thought?
Yeah. I think it's called Infernal Affairs. Anyway, it's a Asian film, and many of the shots in Reservoir Dogs, unbeknownst to a lot of people, are shot for shot. Like, if you go watch the original film and then you watch Reservoir Dogs, you're like, oh my God, this entire sequence, the camera movement, this whole thing, mm-hmm. like, that's from the other movie. And so early on, he was criticized heavily for that. This was the thing people took issue with.
Right.
The interesting thing is that, like, when you start to realize that in art, you know, life imitates art, art imitates life, every creative person is just drawing inspiration from somewhere else.
Of course.
And the best, the most creative people, the best ones are the ones that can get over themselves and just say, like, I'm not going to feel sheepish about stealing this thing. No. I'm just going to combine it with something else I think is cool.
They always say that imitation is the greatest form of flattery.
Yeah.
If you've done something. I mean, it goes back to, like, why every single film class watches Citizen Kane.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean? You got to do it. You got to pull from things that have happened.
Rosebud.
I'm watching old episodes of The Simpsons right now.
Yes.
And I was watching, like, Mr. Burns just walks into a room and he's like, these 100 monkeys on 100 typewriters. What are they working on now? He's like, it was the best of... get this out of here! It's just time
so
laughing.
So good. So I think it's time to play our game.
Okay, yeah, no problem. The last point I was going to
make
just about Tarantino is that sort of was what started him. And then what's happened in the years since is that now people are very, very used to his style, what makes Tarantino Tarantino. Nobody really criticizes that anymore because it's become part of his filmmaking.
Yeah.
And then even his script, True Romance, is a Tarantino movie that was bought and made by Tony Scott, which feels the least like any Tony Scott movie.
Right,
feels
because like, it's a Tarantino.
Yeah. I believe From Dusk Till Dawn he has a significant amount to do with.
Absolutely.
I know he's in it. I can't remember if he wrote it.
I believe he wrote it, or wrote some of it at least.
Yeah, and so he's just sort of carved out this niche in Hollywood that people try to rip off, but he's really like... He's the guy.
He's the guy.
He's the only Tarantino.
Right.
So anyway, yeah, let's get into the game. So we mentioned earlier this game, it's a top five actors or actresses who we would love to see kind of skyrocketed to the next level or resurrected in their career by a Tarantino project. Do you want to go like one for one?
Let's go one for one.
I wrote six.
I wrote five because it was five.
This is top six.
Fine, I'll do... Okay, my sixth then is going to be... It's going to be Annette Bening. And you said this before the show because I had mentioned, I was like, I feel like I need to do a girl because it's all guys. And I love her in American Beauty.
Yeah.
She's an incredible actress. And I love that she's like method.
Yeah.
I heard on set for that movie, she was just the worst.
The worst.
Everyone hated her.
Yeah.
It's because her character's a bitch.
Yeah.
She's so good. And so she'll be my sixth since this is top five.
Yeah. What was the last? Didn't Annette Bening just a few years ago have an Oscar nod? I feel like she did like 3 years
probably
ago.
I mean, the woman is an incredible actress.
Yeah, yeah.
She just, no one cares about her anymore.
Yeah, yeah, it's
kind of like the woman on your list.
We'll go with her then. Ever heard of an actress named Diane
Alicia Vikander? No.
For those of you that watch the show, you know I have a certain penchant for Diane Lane.
Pendulum.
The reason I put Diane Lane is not because she's not still relevant.
It's because she's smoking hot.
She's still actually in pretty big movies. She's in Trumbo, which Cranston just got nominated for a SAG Award this morning for.
I love that, man.
And she was in Superman, right? She's in Man of Steel.
Yep.
So she's still in big projects.
She is, but she's completely replaceable.
They're never her projects.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so my thing is like, she's awesome, she's smoking hot. If there was like a role, like a really solid role in a Tarantino movie that was like based around, say, like a middle-aged woman, she would be awesome, and I would love to see it.
I know. All right, so for my number five, and this is interesting because it's kind of the same thing that you just talked about Diane Lane, but
Alicia,
I feel like he's
Vikander.
He's
Alicia Vikander.
No, he's even more relevant than she is because he was just in a huge movie, Birdman.
Oh, Keaton?
Norton.
Oh, that's a great one.
I love Edward Norton so much.
Yeah.
He is so talented.
Yeah.
But he just doesn't get, like, American History X is one of my favorite movies of all time. Of course it is.
Weird guy
I am. But to see him in, like, another gnarly, like, gritty role, like, that really, really tests his acting chops, I would love to see Almost More Than Nothing Else.
Yeah.
So that's mine at five.
Yeah, Norton's so good.
So good.
Okay, I'm going to go with one that I'm assuming is on your list, because this is like, I feel like this is almost created by this notion, and it's Nicolas Cage.
Of course it is.
Yeah, it has to be, right?
Yeah, he's my number one.
Yeah, like he's kind of the ultimate actor for it. Like
he's so good.
When he's good, he's great. He's been in so much crap now.
Absolutely.
For so many years that I'm just like...
Like, when's the last Nick Cage movie that came out that you were like, that looks good?
Yeah, even the ones that people would be like, that was good or he was good in it, you know what? He saw them.
No.
Like, Port of Orleans, Bad Lieutenant, that was like 3-4 years ago.
It was all right.
And yeah.
Like Lord of War was all right.
Yeah, and that's a while ago now. Lord of War is like
2006.
Yeah, like seven. I want to say like there's a movie called Joe from two or three years ago.
It's all right.
And people liked it.
Yeah.
But for the most part, Nick Cage hasn't done in at least 5 or 6 years a big project. Like imagine if he was in Hateful Eight. You know what I mean? Imagine if he was all over the screen getting advertised in like a summer or like Christmas, huge release.
Like I would be so excited. I mean, it's the same thing as what we're talking about with Tom Cruise and Mana.
Yeah.
That I cannot wait.
Yeah.
Like, I can't wait.
Yep. Totally hopeful. So, all right. So we both have Cage.
So we got Cage. My next one is Russell Crowe.
Love Russell Crowe.
I love Russell Crowe.
What was his last big project?
Robin Hood? Noah?
Didn't he do something? Oh, Noah. I feel like, wasn't he in like a big movie last year? What are we forgetting? I feel like Russell Crowe was in like something really
I actually
huge.
Have it pulled up right here because I was just looking him up. Who's your next one? But yeah, Russell Crowe. Oh, here we go. Sorry. I just cut you off. So he was in The Nice Guys is coming up.
Oh, yeah.
Fathers and Daughters. He was in Noah. He was in Man of Steel, obviously. But like, yeah. Again, he's not.
What was the last sweet movie?
The last sweet movie? Noah, Winter's Tale, Man of Steel, Broken City, Les Mis, Man with the Iron Fist.
Yeah, Les Mis would be the last, like...
Robin Hood in 2010. Like, nothing.
Yeah, Les Mis would be the last, like, super high-profile dramatic role.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. Yeah, that's good, then. I hadn't thought about that. I still feel like he's kind of an A-lister, like, but it would be awesome to see him. It's the same deal. I went with a guy named Val Kilmer.
He's on my list, too!
Nice, of course
he is. He's next! I love Kilmer! Because in MacGruber... He's the best part of
the whole movie.
And even though Will Forte is, like, again, this is one of my favorite movies of all time. Probably my favorite comedy of all time. But Kilmer? Give me quite
Kilmer's
the fly.
Kilmer's it. Yeah, it didn't work.
We're just going to move right on past that.
Kilmer's it.
Yes, he's absolutely on my list, and it's because he's so awesome.
Sweet. Super sweet.
Who else you got?
I have three more written down. Because I had six.
I only have one more because you've listed two of mine. So why don't you say another one?
Okay.
Everyone steals everything I do. Is that a good thing?
I'm going to go with a little guy. Andrew, listen here. I'm going to go with a little guy I like to call Jack Nicholson.
That's so funny. I almost picked him on my list, but I thought he retired.
He might be.
Yeah.
The last thing I can remember him in was The Departed, and that was like 06.
Yeah. Right? I love Nicholson.
What I was thinking with Nicholson on this was how sweet would it be if, like, there was just some old, disgusting assassin who was just, like,
just dirty.
Walked on, like, a cane, and it was, like, really just dirty and crazy.
It would be him.
Yeah. And Tarantino could just nail it to the wall.
Of course.
Yeah.
I feel like Nicholson might be one of the biggest Tarantino misses ever.
Yeah. Yeah.
He should have had him.
Maybe he still will. I mean, Hackman showed up in Tenenbaums. And that was, like, his last really relevant thing he did. And that was, like, awesome. It was, like, it's probably the most memorable Hackman role I can think of.
Have you seen a little movie called Enemy of the State? All right, so my last one. And it's weird because it's, like, you almost don't want to see it.
Yeah.
But I really do. And I could never see the two of them working together.
Please tell me it's not the same one I have right now.
Mel Gibson.
Oh!
Right?
Yeah.
That'd be so good.
That's almost the best one, actually.
He would just kill it. He would be so good in a role where he's just like a dirty, like,
I think
asshole.
That's maybe the best one. That's maybe the best one on the whole list. Because he's right, crazy, mm-hmm. and he's not liked. But it's not the same as Cruise, where, like, I imagine Cruise, and I'm like, yeah, it'd be awesome if he did it. But at this point in his career, I just can't see it happening. It's just too weird. He wouldn't say fuck that many times.
Mm-hmm.
He did it in Magnolia, because P.T. Anderson's sort of like an analog director in some ways.
Right, right.
But, you know, like, I think Gibson's so, like, sort of so crazy and, like, so, such an aggressive actor in the roles that he's willing to take. Like, if, I think that would be amazing.
Be killer, right?
Yeah. I would love it. Love it.
It's so hard, like, it's so hard to like Mel Gibson anymore. Yeah. But then you go and watch The Patriot. If you go and watch this film called The Patriot.
A little film called.
You go and you watch a little film called The Patriot.
Now, Andrew.
Andrew,
listen here.
All right, so that's our top. Oh, you got another one, don't you?
I got one more. I went with a young man, a young actor, somebody I think that would be great to break through with the Tarantino movie. Shia LaBeouf.
Shia.
Yeah. How good is that?
That's good.
Because he's kind of crazy. Yeah. He's really talented.
And he's super weird.
Yeah. And, like, you just imagine, what if he got, like, a cherry roll, just, like, a really good one?
Dude, I would love I actually really like Shia LaBeouf. Me too. I think he's incredibly talented. He's a weird guy.
It's really weird.
But he's totally the type of guy that's going to win an Oscar in less than 10 years.
Yeah, totally. He'll be in some movie that's going to blow everyone's mind.
Yeah.
And I think he'd be fucking great for a Tarantino movie.
Yeah. Shia LaBeouf and Mel Gibson in
The Patriot, the remake.
With RZA doing the soundtrack.
Oh, God, it'd be amazing.
All right, so looks like we can move on to money, right?
Yeah, Critical and Whatnot. Yeah, okay. Yeah, let's do it.
So this movie only cost $30 million to make.
Really?
Isn't that amazing?
I guess it's because really the vast majority of it is just that one gigantic action sequence.
Blood and wires and there's no – oh, the anime probably cost a good chunk of money.
Yeah.
But still it seems – like it almost seems so low that I want to go check – my numbers again because it seems impossible.
Well, we don't when we do budget, we don't ever actually talk about unless it's in a specific case, like when we did Demolition Man last week and we were like, well, it cost this much, but then it had like an extra $40 million in advertising and promotion. So like, unless there's a specific stat that references that, we actually usually just keep the budget at the budget.
Like that movie we did, what movie was it a couple weeks ago where they spent like an extra like $70 million?
No, so I just said Demolition Man.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, yeah.
I was listening.
You weren't. Nice work. That's going to be a good clip when we show that.
So that's going to be one of our highlight moments. I wasn't listening. I'll just be honest.
Demolition Man last week when we said that they spent an extra $40 million.
What was that movie that we just talked about? It's like when you reread exactly what I just written earlier.
Pretty good.
Look, we're doing this great. We're doing a great job.
I was at a holiday party last night, Andrew.
I am just a drunk,
Doesn't take care of himself. This just in. We work at the same place.
Yeah, well, worked. So, yes, studio was Miramax, $30 million to make. It opened in October of 2003, and it grossed $70 million domestic. So it was a huge success.
You know,
it doubles its budget, and then it grossed another $110 worldwide. $181 million on a $30 million budget is just phenomenal. I bet the studios were happy, too, since they were going to make another movie.
Damn fine, Jeeves.
Damn fine. Damn that. Damn him. Damn that man.
Damn him. Damn that man. I like the fist shake, too.
Oh, he's so good.
Does he do it in the movie?
I don't think so.
I think we just added it.
I think he just...
damn him. Damn boy. That man.
Wilkinson's
you
so
You dream,
good.
General.
You dream, General.
The best. That was a Patriot reference.
We love that movie.
We did the film several weeks ago. You can watch the episode.
Can't get over it. It opened number one at $22 million. I believe it was like their School of Rock out as well. And there was other other like big movies that were out
School
at the time.
School of Rock.
And this movie is, again, Ben's favorite list. Our critical reception. It's got an 8.1, which puts
IMDb.
It in the top 250 at number 169.
This is definitely the 169th best movie ever made.
I know.
I'm quitting the show.
I'm quitting the show. I quit. Burning my suit. Rotten Tomatoes got an 85 from all critics, 80% from top, 80 from audience.
People love this movie.
It's a good movie.
What is this?
It's a very good movie. It's well made. It's almost as good as The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3.
But not quite.
It's like at least 10 times better.
And I suggest we move on.
let's look at the numbers here. We'll look at Quentin Tarantino's breakdown. Give me a little zoom on that.
You got a page. It's your final page.
Shit.
So adjusted for ticket price inflation. That's Pulp Fiction is the first one on the list, $211 million.
Yep.
Was very successful. Django would be number two at just shy of $171 million. Inglourious Bastards, then you have the Kill Bill film. So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
This is just right dead center.
Yeah, it is. And it, for me, it feels like, I don't know, I feel like it's the most important movie he did after 2000.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, like, I know Django and Inglourious were big, but
see, that's the weird thing. That'll speak to my point a bit more about the way that I perceive this movie.
Yeah. I mean, again, we this is complete polar
different
opposites.
Experience. Yeah. So, and I guess actually, I understand now. It makes a little more sense to me why this movie feels like such a classic to you. It's because of the age you were and like what it represented and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's obviously reviewed very well. So you were told by your peers and everyone else at the time, like, you are correct in thinking this is great.
Right.
So you are validated in holding this on a pedestal. For some reason, I just didn't feel the same way about it. But like, I think about Django and Inglourious Basterds. People fucking love Tarantino movies.
They
like,
do.
They go love them. Nuts. They get Oscar nominations. They win Oscars. He's huge. They make a ton of money. They appeal to this gigantic audience. But I feel the same way about Inglourious and Django that I felt about Kill Bill, which is like they were just.
Right.
It's just a Tarantino movie. Is kind of my feeling.
But it's so weird because
But I'm in the minority here.
Right, but Hateful Eight, no one would want to see that movie if it wasn't a Tarantino movie.
Yeah.
You know, because, like, you watch the trailers, and the first trailer was just, like, nothing, and the second trailer finally, like, let you know what was going on, like, the story of it.
Yeah.
And it looks cool, but I would not be even remotely excited to see it on the same level. It would not even be in the same, like, stratosphere. Like,
it's interesting that worldwide, Django was by far his most successful movie. See that? $425 million worldwide?
Yeah.
And Inglourious at 321. That's, like, pretty fascinating. Like, that, I guess that movie, and that's his most recent movie. It's like Tarantino, like, that's why he can get the budget to do whatever he wants. And I was listening to, I was listening to Paul Scheer and Rob Hubel on, Nerdist podcast, like, a couple weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And they're talking about they were in, like, Telluride for the film festival, and they saw Tarantino's crew there, and they were, like, filming Hateful Eight or something like that, or maybe it was a different movie, but the movie that had to be in the snow, like a significant amount of snow.
Right.
And there was no snow. So the entire crew was just waiting around for snow.
Just waiting for it to snow.
Waiting for it to snow. That's the kind of freedom that he gets to make his movies for some, like.
Right.
I mean,
day six of shooting, just waiting.
For snow. His last movie made $425 million. So Hateful Eight, like, here's the keys, dude. Do whatever you want with the
car.
You're
going to, because I'm going to go see it in theaters. So are you.
Yep, 100%. You know? That's pretty fascinating.
Just for the mustache, really.
I can't
wait to touch his mustache.
I can't wait to do Tombstone, guys. After last week, I was so butthurt.
He was very upset
that we didn't get to do Tombstone. I think my rejection of Kill Bill has more to do with the fact that I wanted to talk about Tombstone so much.
It did. It is. Let's see. Axel here, one of our good fans, is like, I'm totally watching Tombstone tomorrow.
Yeah.
I can't wait. Okay, so Tombstone and the movie we're going to do on the show next week, and we'll talk about it during the pitch. Ben is very excited about it. I'll just say that.
Yeah.
I've seen both those movies about once.
And I've seen both of those movies probably 50 or 60 times.
Exactly.
Maybe Tombstone like 20. This other movie that we're going to talk about at the end, I've literally seen like 70 times.
Yeah. Which is funny because it's like the Patriot feeling for me because you've never seen it. And I was so excited.
Yeah.
Kill Bill, it's a little different.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, all right. So that's enough with the money. I want to talk about these reviews because I pulled them pretty specifically for you and me.
Yeah.
With this movie. The first one is from Peter Rayner from New York Magazine. He says, there is no ironic overlay in Tarantino's movie. No commenting on the pop schlock he's replicating. He simply wants to remake it in his own way, the kinds of movies he's always loved. And he's about as uncynical as a movie geek can be. And that's what we talk about. I mean, like, he does it. He pulls and he does it in tribute of these other movies.
Yep.
And he puts it all together in a way that's just completely palatable and enjoyable.
Yep. Yeah, people love it.
And the other one is, I want you to read it because it's I'll read it and you can agree with it. Structurally and narratively amputated, Volume 1 retains
head and guts, it loses its heart,
and Gams to the second installment.
That was like a dual effort.
I don't know why.
I did the middle, and you finished it.
We're going to start doing one word at a time on the show.
We finish each other's sentences sometimes on
sandwiches.
The show.
We finish each other's sandwiches. And the reason I picked that is because you like the second one a lot more than the first one.
It's funny because I saw both of them in theaters. I only saw each of them once.
Mm-hmm.
But my feeling was that the second movie was more of a drama and I just sort of liked the character a bit more.
It's a good movie.
I also liked, if I recall, I really liked David Carradine. I thought he was great.
He's good.
Yeah, and I think I enjoyed that he was in the second movie. Plus you get more Michael Madsen, which I like as well.
I know, I do love, what's his name, Bill? No, Bill Buck.
Buck, yeah. Those were, and I think I always liked Madsen, obviously, because of, what's it called?
Reservoir Dogs.
Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah. When he's screaming in the ear, one of the best moments.
That's such a good movie.
Yeah.
Okay. That's our critical reviews.
That's it. Yeah.
Let's get into the last bits of the show. Well, not the last bits, but all of the other games we play. So this is favorite line, guys. That's pretty self-explanatory. So anime podcast, if you want to share your favorite one with us, or leave it in the comments.
Charlie Brown, John. That's not my favorite line.
And I will take this moment really quickly to remind everybody that we are on iTunes. We go up as audio and video every single week. So give us a rating and a review. The mugs that we promised all of you, you'll be getting as your Christmas presents.
Yeah.
It's our solemn promise.
Next Christmas.
Yeah. So believe us when we say it, that the mugs will be coming
2017
very
soon. Is going to be a big year.
If you're watching this episode and you were announced as a mug winner, 16. Some of you probably don't know because you're not watching this or you missed it when we announced. We still remember and have them written down, so we'll take care of our part. But if you do have it, just email. What is our podcast? What's the email? Is it actionmovieanatomy@gmail.com?
I think it's amapodcast@gmail, but we should.
Yeah.
We don't remember.
Yeah. I guess either leave it in the YouTube comments or tweet at us. and that is what you should do, and let us know your address and your name. Several of you have, but just if you know you won and you never got it, just let us know and we'll get it straight out to you.
Right.
So, and then lastly, the Popcorn Talk Network, it does other shows every single Friday. Anatomy of a Movie, which is kind of like our sister show. Mm-hmm. They do the other, all the rest of the movies that we don't do. They do all the new movies every single week in their own style.
Oh my God, how bad do you want to see Creed?
So bad.
I want to see it so badly.
Yeah, I still haven't watched
it. It's just incredible.
That's all I hear, yeah. So this is normally set at the top of the show, but just because I forgot. So this is the moment that we did this time. So check that out. Let's get into favorite line.
I want you to go first.
Okay. So I was originally going to go with my favorite line was actually my fist bump. So that was like my initial thought.
Okay.
But I switched it, and this is kind of fucked up, guys. But I went with this because Buck as a character.
The views expressed by Ben Baden do not reflect that of Popcorn Talk Network or Andrew Guy.
So Buck, who likes to fuck, who has the pussy wagon, and has been violating the comatose body of Uma Thurman for quite a while. She finds out when she wakes up. He's just like a disgusting character. He's also Uncle Jesse in Breaking Bad.
Of course it's Uncle Jack.
Uncle Jack.
Yeah.
In Breaking Bad, which is awesome. Like, and it's funny.
I can't believe when you told me that, I almost was too proud to admit that I didn't recognize.
I could tell. I was like, what's Uncle what in Breaking Bad?
I was like, Uncle Jack.
You're like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
I was like, in Breaking Bad, the uncle, that's him.
And I was like, oh, yeah, Uncle Jack. And then I sat there for a moment and had, like, my whole world crumbled around me. It's like, how does he know this? And I don't know this. I almost killed you. I didn't want it to leave the room. But, yeah, I was like, holy shit, because Uncle Jack is so good.
Yeah.
I literally just went back and rewatched the entire series of Breaking Bad in October. First of all, if you haven't seen that show, go watch it now. Turn off our show and go watch that and then come back.
It's better than our show.
Please, you didn't get to your line yet.
So he has several lines that I really like. The one that the PG one that I'll go with is when she's bashing his head with the door and he like has brain damage.
Yeah.
She hits him like three times and he's like, please stop hitting my head.
Please stop hitting me. His head's all like smaller. Yeah. Oh, I love it.
That line. But the one that is just the grossest and most twisted line is when he's about to sell the corpse. And he's like, yeah, the pipes don't work down there no more, so feel free to come at her.
And you're just like... The views are those of the hosts only, and not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Feel free to come at her all you want.
It's just like the grossest...
It's so disgusting.
It's so twisted. It's like... It's just grimy, but it's like...
It's perfect.
He wanted him to be like this disgusting, sleazy, funnily sleazy character.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I can't... You can't help but laugh.
Yeah.
At the character.
You could, because it's written and acted so well.
And that's one of those moments Tarantino...
My best part moment is when he shows the Petroleum Jelly. It's all like it's hairy all crusty. And crusty and brown. Oh, God.
Yeah.
Just the most disgusting. Cool.
Great.
You proud of yourself?
I feel dirty.
Okay, you should. I have a couple.
Okay, great.
As usual. My first one is when Hattori Hanzo is talking and he says, if you encounter God on your journey, even God will be cut, when he talks about the sword, because you're just like, God. Like, never has a sword been so sweet, ever. And then it even proceeds to go on when she's fighting with it, just cuts other swords in half.
Yeah.
I love it. My other line, though, it's my favorite, and it's from the trailer, and it's Michael Madsen, and it's just delivered so well. It's, that woman deserves her revenge.
Yeah, the Madsen line.
And we... deserve to die.
Yeah, it's really
so good.
Yeah.
Yeah, so those are my two lines.
For the record, I in no way support the character. It's disgusting. That's appalling behavior. I just think the line in the movie is funny. Just make
it
extremely clear.
If you want to unfollow Ben on Twitter, you can unfollow him at Ben Baten Media.
All right, moving on. I'm embarrassed.
Don't be. No, it's good. It's disgusting, but it's there for a reason. It's written perfectly. Exactly.
So we realized just before the show today that we are about to do the villain hero ranking as well as the top 50. We didn't update the lists from last week with the Demolition Man, so you'll notice.
Yeah, it's been a very busy week. We apologize.
Yeah. So when we just got here and we were loading it up. So you guys should note that there is one more movie missing and also that we're blind.
Why don't we do this? Why don't we do both next week? You want to do that?
Add them both?
Yeah.
Do you want to just do hero villain ranking right now, or do you want to... We can do top 50 next week, maybe.
I just don't like sitting here and staring at the lists.
Because you're blind.
Because I'm blind, and we talk about it forever.
We can just... Let's loosely riff on it.
Okay.
And we want to decide the number.
Okay.
All right, then.
All right, so we're gonna do hero villain ranking?
Yeah.
But we'll just loosely do it.
Yeah, we can just riff on it. Like, okay. Where do we... For me, personally.
She ranks for me.
Uma Thurman does.
Yeah.
Yeah, the bride. Yeah, I mean, she's a badass character, no doubt. And she's got, she's got a good run and like, she's very unique. There's not a whole lot of, like, strong female characters that are quite at this level.
Yeah.
So, and she gets all her revenge. She gets so much revenge.
I love revenge movies.
Yeah.
They're some of my absolute favorite. I mean, Old Boy is probably my favorite movie of all time.
Oh, when she slashes Buck's fucking Achilles with the sword.
Yeah, I remember you were just like, I knew it was coming.
Oh. And then she bashes his head in with a door.
So gnarly.
I love the moment, too, when she's realizing it. She's realizing what's happening. She's remembering it all.
Right.
And she's, like, coming out of the coma.
My name's Buck.
Yeah.
And I'm here to fuck.
Your name's Buck.
Right?
Right? And just...
Yeah. And you're here to fuck. Right?
Yeah.
And then, slam, dead. So good.
That's pretty great. But I have to really think about it because now the list gets so tight, but like, she can't be higher than top 20 for me.
She's got to be in my top 20, I think. Yeah.
She's probably somewhere between 30 and 40 for me, I guess, but really? She might be like 28.
Okay.
I'd want to look at the list.
I'd put her in the top 20 for me. Yeah. Villains, nah.
Yeah, none of them really.
Because if you were going to rank Bill as a villain, yeah. I don't think you can put Kill Bill 1
it's
as
Kill
his
Bill
movie.
Two.
It's Kill Bill 2. Yeah, and even then, he's not even like. Like, he's evil, but it's in such
character.
A weird way.
Yeah, for sure.
And then for the movie, it's probably in my top, like, top 15, top 20.
Really?
I love this movie. Yeah.
It's a much better movie than I was willing to give it credit for when we talked about doing it. And I will rank it as such. Like, when we do it, I'm sure I'll throw it into my list, like, a little bit more, you know, ahead of movies like John Wick, ahead of movies like... But then it's going to hit a point where it's like, I still enjoy movies like Predator, and I still enjoy movies like Speed more. So, you know, it'll be somewhere in that sort of like in the 20s range would be my guess.
Right.
But we'll see. We'll address it next week when we have the updated list.
Absolutely. So
for recast this week,
we have a new style of recast today. And, the reason that we did this is because it's kind of like, it's not old enough,
yeah.
But it's not new enough to like pick between the two categories that we usually do, like 80s and 90s or present.
Yeah.
But I thought it'd be cool if we did something called an action movie dream team, which is where you go through and you can pick any actor or actress from any point in their career and plug them in as that in this movie. So, for instance, like if you wanted to take Russell Crowe from Gladiator and you wanted to take Jamie Foxx from Django Unchained, you could do that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
So, we decided to recast the bride, who you don't ever find out her name in the movie, but if you do pause the movie when she's buying her plane ticket, it says Beatrix Kiddo on it.
Okay.
So, the bride are Beatrix Kiddo, Vernita Green, Oren Ishii, Sophie Faitel, and I believe it says Buck Who Likes to Fuck.
Yes.
on here.
It's a good character.
It is. So, I'm going to start with my Buck.
Yeah.
And for me... It's Philip Seymour Hoffman from Patch Adams.
Scotty J.
Scotty J. From Patch Adams. Because he's just a fuck in that movie. He's so like condescending and dickish. And I think, I mean, you can almost do a combination of Philip Seymour Hoffman and that, and also Along Came Polly.
I miss him so dearly.
I love him so much. So I think the pinnacle, the combination of Philip Seymour Hoffman from Along Came Polly and Patch Adams is perfect.
Okay, for my buck, he likes to fuck.
I
went with Matt Dillon from like Something About Mary era.
Yeah.
Because like the scene when Ben Stiller first walks into like the private eye office and he's like, hey, nice to meet you. And he like stands up and he's like starts buttoning his pants back. His pants down around his ankles. Just such a sleazy fuck.
So good. So good.
That movie is one of the great
like underrated comedies
ever.
Yeah,
it's like
it was so huge though when it came out.
Yeah. But like it doesn't get referenced or talked about anywhere near as much as it should. The cum on the ear is like something that still gets like that's a thing that people reference now. Is that a hair gel?
Yeah.
But aside from that,
it's a good line.
Yeah. But the movie itself is so full of good lines. I mean, Matt Dillon is just incredible. So he'd be perfect for Buck.
Okay. So my Sophie Faitel, is another Sophie actually,
Sophia Vergara.
Sophia Vergara.
I love minions.
No. Sophie, if you saw that, we apologize.
Yeah.
It's Sophie Marceau from The World Is Not Enough.
Oh.
Yeah. She's good.
People loved her.
Yeah. She was smoking hot. And
French Sophie Marceau.
The French. And she's all killing it with the end. And like you just dropped another pen.
Yeah. Doesn't she have like some sort of weird like shirt look or like a thing on her arm or something? What is it? Doesn't she have some sort of like...
I don't know, dude.
Okay. But anyway.
That movie is so bad.
It's a very bad film. The best part of that movie...
is her.
Is Denise Richards in a white shirt swimming.
I... could not agree with you more, actually.
Okay, my Sophie Fatale. I went with Gwyneth Paltrow.
In? Don't say Shakespeare in Love.
Well, I couldn't decide on the age because, like, the reality is Gwyneth Paltrow, when she's really young, like in Emma or in, like, Sliding Doors, doesn't really look all that different or feel all that different than, like, Gwyneth Paltrow in Iron Man 3.
Yeah, she's, like, the same person.
So I feel like you could just kind of go with Gwyneth Paltrow from almost, like, any era.
Anything.
But I guess I'd go, like, mid-2000s Gwyneth Paltrow, like, okay. 04 kind of era, you know? Not quite up to Iron Man. Maybe like Iron Man 1 era. There you go.
So, okay.
So like 08.
She's pretty hot in that.
She's smoking.
Yeah.
Love.
Definitely a fan. Definitely a fan.
Definitely my style.
She's a sweetheart too in real life. Met her a couple times.
Really?
Her mom, Blythe Danner, they used to come to this place I worked at. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
They're cool.
I'm jealous.
Yeah. Nick Cage also came in there. Just a little, just throw that in there.
I'm not really much of a name dropper.
Really.
Nick Cage, Gwyneth Paltrow, Mick Jagger.
Vernita Green.
Okay.
I had to do it again, and I know that I did it a couple weeks ago, but it's Danai Gurira. It's Michonne.
Oh, gotcha.
Because that fight scene is sweet.
Yeah, I mean, that's, like, pretty perfect.
I know.
I went younger. I went Zoe Saldana.
Will Smith.
I went Zoe Saldana.
Zoe Saldana.
Yeah.
I like that.
Cool. I also did consider Jada Pinkett Smith. Younger Jada Pinkett, yeah. But I like Zoe Saldana better.
What was that movie that she was in that was, like, kind of an action movie?
Collateral?
No, Zoe. She was
Colombiana.
Colombiana.
Yeah.
Didn't see it.
No, neither did I. But she
could pull it off.
And she can, like, do the action hero thing. She's just a little young to pull off, like, being a mom.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, not that much younger.
She could pull it off.
Yeah, she could do it. And definitely. She's got the, like, the body and the moves to, like, do the action thing.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Already is she! Yeah. Who's your O-Ren? I think we have the same.
Maggie Q.
Maggie Q.
Mission Impossible 3, Maggie Q.
I went Live Free or Die.
Okay.
Yeah, Maggie Q.
Die Hard
or whatever it is.
it's so weird that Lucy Liu was cast for this. And Tarantino, when he saw her in, was it Charlie's Angels?
It was Charlie's Angels.
He rewrote the role to be
Chinese American. Was it Charlie's Angels?
He saw her in something significant.
That she was sweet in.
And rewrote the role for her. But it's so weird because I never would have thought of her as, like, a badass. It just never would have occurred to me.
But she's so good.
She's
great. Yeah.
Her one scene where she chops the dude's head off.
Oh, her delivery is so good.
She's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's really good.
Oh, you know what one of my other favorite line is?
What?
It's when Gogo's walking down the stairs.
Yeah.
And Uma Thurman says something and she does, like, the little Japanese schoolgirl laugh. She's like,
yeah.
And then she's like, and then she drops, like, no, like, really deep voice. She's like, you call that begging? Like, oh, it's so sweet.
Do you love that chick?
I love her.
You had, like, a huge crush on her,
I
kind of
had a huge crush on her when I was a kid. It's like, I love that woman. So who did you cast as your bride and from when?
Elizabeth Shue, 1995, leaving Las Vegas era. She has muscular thighs. She could handle the role of an action star.
Okay. I'm not opposed to it if that's what you think. I don't think it's a good cast.
Did I mention she has muscular thighs?
She is beautiful. I love her.
Yeah.
In that movie.
I love her in Adventures in Babysitting.
And I'm sure you do. I went with a little person you may have heard of. Her name is Ellen Ripley.
You went with Sigourney?
I went with Sigourney via Aliens. Her body's banging.
She's badass. Hot.
She's a total badass.
She's super badass. She wears those sweet Reeboks.
Yeah, she does.
Sweet in the Aliens suit. Reeboks.
Yeah. Which I guess in this movie, I didn't see it, but... when there's a shot where they go underneath the ground, you can see Uma's shoes.
Oh, they say, fuck you,
it says,
right?
Fuck you on them?
Yeah.
I've never seen it.
Yeah,
I
read it. I didn't notice.
Yeah. But yeah, so that's my The Bride. I'm going to go with Sigourney from then.
Well, our next section is called Cage versus Cruise. I think it's pretty clear Nick Cage would have played the better bride than Tom Cruise.
I think that Tom Cruise would have played the better bride.
I mean, they both look good with long hair, but Nick Cage has more of a widow's peak.
He has an incredible widow's peak.
You didn't think it would be that easy, did you?
I like how... That's O-Ren. You know, for a minute there, I kind of did. I like that we took out Ultimate Action Scene from the show because we kept finding out that it didn't really, like...
Yeah.
It wasn't very...
Didn't vibe with the show.
Even though we could have done a great one for this movie.
This is like...
And somehow, after 7-8 months... Cage versus Cruise is still on here. We skip it almost every week.
It's a good little thing
it's
to just have on there,
that
though.
We got.
It's a great bit for us. You have to listen.
We enjoy doing it. All right, so we're going to move on to
I
which...
I was just admiring your cage. That's you pretty good.
Now we're going to go into our categories, Ben. And what are our three categories?
There are three action movie categories. They are totally legitimate. Those are movies like Die Hard and Terminator 2, The Matrix, films that are just pound for pound great movies. They don't really make you unintentionally laugh. They're well made, and you just believe in them as movies. Like, you don't say that to someone, they're like, oh, that's a ridiculous movie.
Right.
At least somebody in the know, anyway. There are movies that are totally ridiculous, and those are movies like Face Off and Con Air that really just kind of make you laugh the whole time. And you have to think that when they were making them, the filmmakers were in on the joke a little bit. Or maybe they're not, and that's why they're
that's
totally
why,
ridiculous.
Yeah, exactly.
And then there's legitimately ridiculous or ridiculously legitimate, which is the middle category, which is movies like The Rock and movies like Speed, movies like Point Break, where they're just sort of perfectly engaging movies. They're awesome all throughout. They have one really good performance usually that kind of sells the movie on another level for you. But you kind of do laugh unintentionally. Like Predator is like a classic example.
Yeah, it's a good example.
Where it's awesome the whole way, but you're just laughing the whole time. But you're still like, this is so sweet. That's ridiculous. Legitimate.
Yeah. I want to hear your category. I want to hear yours first, and I want to know why. Because I remember you talking about it shifting, maybe.
Yeah, I mean...
Might not have, but...
I think, again, you're just remembering last week's episode.
No. I know what you're talking about. When I just said that, I remembered. I was like, oh, yeah, that happened last week, too.
No, I think I would have to go totally legitimate. It's so really weird to say that, though, because but it's so intentional in everything that it does.
Mm-hmm.
I don't in any way feel like this movie is trying to do something that it fails to do.
Right.
It's like everything that I'm supposed to feel when I feel it, I feel. So,
yeah, and like you laugh when you're supposed to laugh. There's not really many. I think I'm going to agree. Even though it seems so crazy because of like all the blood splurting and the music and the feel of the whole movie.
Yeah.
But it is totally legit.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think so.
I would agree.
And now I'm going to introduce the next segment so that you can just do it on your own because I know how excited you are. Okay, so we've started doing this thing called The Pitch, where we talk about the movie that we're going to do next
it's
week on the show.
The Pitch!
Sorry. Get really excited sometimes. So this is where we talk about this movie that we're going to do next week. We're going to get you pumped up. We're going to get you amped to watch it. And you're going to watch it before next Wednesday. And I'm going to let Ben take it from here because... Why am I letting you take it from here?
This is my single favorite movie of all time. I'm going to give you guys a little
Bridget
excerpt.
Bridget Jones' Diary.
I'm going to give you guys an excerpt from the film. Bodhi, this is your fucking wake-up call. I am an FBI agent. Utah,
get me too.
The film is Point Break. If you aren't aware of what Point Break is, then you're about to be, because this is the best movie ever. This is my favorite movie of all time. My older brother gave me a VHS copy of the tape when I was a kid. Because I ate up everything my brother gave me because he's 9 years older than I did.
Right.
Thought it was the coolest thing I'd ever seen. It's the perfectly ridiculous legitimate movie because the movie's so silly, but it's the best thing Swayze ever did. Swayze is my all-time favorite actor, even more than Tom Cruise. Patrick Swayze is my number one. This is his best role. It's a nonstop adrenaline thrill ride. It says it on the box. It's they're bank rob. I mean, the premise of the movie is that they're bank robbing surfers.
Do you need a change of pants?
I'm so excited. I love Patrick Swayze in this movie. I love Keanu Reeves in this movie. John C. McGinley in this movie.
Busey
is fantastic. Laurie Petty's great. Like, the whole movie is just so sweet. If you've seen Hot Fuzz, they reference this movie quite a bit.
They absolutely do.
There's a remake.
You remember when you're back and shot your gun in the air like, oh.
Yeah. It's the best. This is my favorite movie ever. I can't wait to do it.
Our audience is stoked.
They're stoked?
They're very excited.
Yeah. The remake of Point Break is coming out on Christmas, and they made a mistake in the remake by not casting a superstar in the Bodhi role.
Yeah.
Because Swayze, at the time the movie came out, was in his People's Sexiest Man Alive 1990 era Swayze with the mane of hair.
The amount of times that you've referenced Swayze in his People's Sexiest Man Alive era.
Do you know that it was the background of my computer for a long time?
That's so not okay.
The cover.
That is not okay.
I'm a fan. I pay respect to the dead. He wasn't dead yet. It's my favorite. It's the best. There's a remake coming out. I'm hoping that the remake is at least serviceably good.
I'll have to see if I like Point Break as much as I like Roadhouse.
Yeah, I mean, Roadhouse is sweet, but Roadhouse is super over-the-top ridiculous.
Yeah, it's
and we all know
ridiculous.
The best movies we do on the show are the middle category.
Yes,
they're always
true.
The most classic. And Point Break is just the fucking best.
Yeah.
It's the fucking best. Yeah! So,
right, calm down, boy. Calm
that's
down.
That's the pitch, guys.
That's the pitch. I hope you guys are at least half as excited as Ben.
I'm going to be doing a one-man show next week. And in that show, I'll be reenacting the entire film doing
shot for shot
all the characters. It's Keanu in his first action role.
Stop.
Okay.
That's the show.
What a good one.
It was a fun one. What absolutely. A good show. Even though it was Kill Bill.
Yeah. We had fun. We always have fun on the show.
Yeah, we do.
So, guys, thank you for stopping by and checking the show out. If you want to follow us on Twitter, you can follow us at AMA Podcast. You can find me at Ben Bateman Media on Twitter and Instagram.
You can find me at Andrew Guy on Twitter.
And otherwise, we will see you guys next week for Point Break. Happy holidays. Merry Christmas coming up.
Take care.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.